Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what a young American learned by exploring the former Soviet Union. We'll spend this hour with writer and comedian Audrey Murray. Inspired by a series of Russian boyfriends, she set out on a 9-month quest through Belarus, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, and Russia, among other destinations. She'd be the first to tell you her decision was a little impulsive, and it turned out to have been more than a little dangerous. We'll talk with her about what she discovered in that challenging year of travel, about the legacies of Soviet bloc culture, and about herself. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
Audrey Murray is not one to shrink from a challenge. She's a stand-up comedian who moved to Shanghai to coach Chinese students looking to ace the SATs in English. As a lot of her friends started to find lucrative traditional jobs and settle down to get married, she realized she didn't want those things, at least not yet. Her dream was very different, less glamorous maybe, but far more adventurous. She wanted to take the better part of a year off to explore the now independent countries of the former Soviet Union. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. As we'll hear from Audrey Murray herself, she had no idea what she was in for. Her memoir of that extraordinary trip is called Open Mic Night in Moscow and Other Stories from My Search for Black Markets, Soviet Architecture, and Emotionally Unavailable Russian Men. She joins us from the studios of NPR in New York to talk about it. Audrey, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you become obsessed with Russian language and Russian culture?
Well, I think the short answer is a series of Russian boyfriends, but I think it was actually more than that. I think it was, first of all, the fact that I had grown up, in the U.S., and my parents had grown up during the Cold War and sort of saw the Soviet Union, I think, as this very scary place. And when I started to learn more about it through these boyfriends, what I found was this sort of like interesting duality where Russian culture is actually very warm and welcoming. And yeah, the more I found out about it, the more I wanted to see what it was like there.
So you had done a college semester in Paris. You moved to Shanghai after college. Did you consider yourself a really seasoned traveler before you started this trip?
You know, I didn't, because I hadn't really taken an extended solo trip before. So I think living in a foreign country is very different from traveling through a place you really don't know anything about. And so when I landed in Kazakhstan, really up until that point, the sort of most adventurous trip I had taken had been a week-long trip in Western China, where at least I spoke the language enough to get by and I was familiar with the culture and the country. And so, yeah, it was a little daunting.
Your first chapter opens with you opening up for a meditative drum circle in Kazakhstan with stand-up comedy. I think even for those of us who have never performed, we can understand that's got to be a tough gig. Did you get a sense for the Kazakh sense of humor?
You know, I think, so I've done comedy in a lot of different countries. And what I find really interesting is I think people are drawn to very similar topics in stand-up. I think that no matter where you go, you're probably going to hear stories about dating. You're probably going to hear stories about, you know, sort of the banality of office life and how much you don't like your job. But what I found a little bit different in the former Soviet Union is I think it's not really a culture where people are used to laughing out loud. And you see that in a lot of like Northern European countries as well. Rather than laughing at stand-up comedy, they'll clap, which in the U.S., if you get an applause break, that is a huge deal. And there you're kind of getting it after every joke, but also no laughs. So it was a very, it can be a little unsettling at first until you get used to it.
So at the time you decided to take this trip, your dreams for yourself felt really different from what your friends wanted. You were not thinking you had to have the perfect job or a wedding or a baby. Did you think, why can't I want what everybody else wants? Or did you think, what is wrong with these women and why do they want those things? Or neither?
No, I think I thought the first one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I thought, you know, well, why is it that I don't seem to be drawn to the same thing everyone else is drawn to? And am I missing something really important about the appeal of, you know, getting married or having children or even just like having sort of a more settled, stable job in life? And yeah, I was like, maybe I'm really not seeing something huge and I'm going to wake up in 5 years and think, oh my God, I really wanted this all along. And it took me a long time to realize that, no, that wasn't true. Maybe I just had different priorities.
So you call your decision to take almost a year off and travel through the former Soviet Union somewhat impulsive. What did you think the experience might do for you?
You know, I think I hoped that it would sort of help me grapple with these things I was thinking a lot about that you just mentioned. You know, what should I be doing with my life? Is it important to find a partner or have a family? But I think I was also hoping that it would sort of like help me understand why I kept having Russian boyfriends and why that seemed to be such a recurring pattern in my life. But I don't think I went into it thinking like, oh, this will be a big spiritual journey and I will completely change my life and I don't know, I'll come out with a very different outlook. I think I really saw it as travel, learning about a new country, learning about new places, but not necessarily like self-transformation. And weirdly, that kind of ended up happening anyway.
So you did create an itinerary. How did you decide where you would go and what areas you would skip?
I did not create an itinerary before I left. I created it on the fly.
Okay.
So a lot of it really just came down to logistics. I knew I really wanted to go to Central Asia because I had spent a little bit of time in Western China. And it's somewhat similar culture. There's people who speak Turkic languages. There's the history of the Silk Road. And so I knew I was really interested in that region. And then I knew that I really wanted to go to Belarus because I'd heard so much about it through a Belarusian boyfriend. And the rest, I sort of like connected the dots and I ran out of time. I didn't get to go to Georgia, Armenia, or Azerbaijan. And I sort of like got to the end of my trip and was like, oh, I forgot to go to Moldova. So those places are on my next to travel to list.
So you hadn't looked very thoroughly into like which places would require you to obtain a visa in advance. That became a really big deal on your trip. You say that you kind of filed this away as a problem for future Audrey. Are you one of those people who are wired to assume that the things you want to do will just work themselves out?
That's an interesting question. I've never thought about it that way, but I guess hearing you say that, I probably, yeah. I mean, I definitely worry about those things a lot right before they become an issue for me. But yeah, I guess I sort of have always just kind of, if I want to do something, I just do it and figure it out as I'm going along. And so I suppose there must be some like underlying assumption that I can figure it out.
What were the requirements to receive a visa for some of the places that you wanted to visit? Was there anything that struck you as odd?
Yeah, so Belarus makes you buy special Belarusian health insurance. Mm-hmm. And this has changed a little bit, by the way, because now tourists can go to Belarus visa-free from a lot of different countries, including the United States. But when I went, you had to buy health insurance that was specifically for Belarus, and it was very affordable. I mean, I was really worried that I wouldn't be able to go to Belarus when I found out about that requirement because, you know, thinking from an American perspective, health insurance is very expensive. And I think it ended up being like $5 for 5 days. So I was really wondering like what that would even cover and how they came to implement that rule. Like, were people coming in and taking advantage of their national healthcare system? So yeah, that one really struck me as odd.
One of the experiences you had was somebody who was really frustrated, like people didn't know where Belarus was and that it was European. And you were like, yeah, how would anyone not know this? I mean, how much did you know about Belarus before you went?
Well, I knew a bit about Belarus before I went, but the person you're talking about is a former boyfriend, Anton, who I'm write about in the book. And I think he and some of his Belarusian friends really were surprised at how little the outside world knew of Belarus. And when he first told me that, I honestly knew very little about Belarus. But I guess being with him, I certainly asked him a lot of questions about it. And, you know, when you're dating someone, I think you just tend to get more of a sense of what a place might be like. So I showed up with some really strong ideas of what I would find. And then a lot of that ended up not being true. Like, I think I really thought that because Belarus was such a closed and often quite restrictive country, that I would encounter a lot of, maybe not so much like hostility, but there wouldn't be a lot of goodwill towards an American. But the opposite was true. I found so many people in Belarus were so quick to help someone as soon as they realized it was a foreigner, and who were so happy to talk to me and very generous with their time. So it was kind of a good surprise.
A lot of the places you went, you met women who really wanted to help you, to reach out to you. They wanted to give you your phone number and say, if you run into trouble, let me know. I mean, I wonder what that feels like. Were you thinking, what do I not know about this place that I've just arrived in?
Absolutely. Every time that happened, and that happened quite a lot, especially in Kyrgyzstan, I would just meet a woman in a taxi, because taxis tend to be shared. And she would say, oh, here's my number. Call me if you have any problems. I would be like, oh, my God, I must be in one of the most dangerous countries on earth without realizing it. I mean, I hadn't read anything in any of my guidebooks that said, like, oh, be careful. Kyrgyzstan is especially dangerous for tourists. And, yeah, so I thought that it was really bad. And I later found out, and also my experiences there confirmed, that that's not true, that Kyrgyzstan is generally a pretty safe country.
Hmm. What's it like to spend the night in a rental yurt?
Well, cold, depending on what time of year you go. Mm-hmm. So the way that yurts are heated is there's a stove in the middle of the yurt, and there is a hole in the top of the ceiling that allows the smoke to, it goes out through the hole, so it doesn't stay in the yurt, mm-hmm. I guess. So that fire goes out about halfway through the night, and I would just wake up, and I was so cold. Like, the type of cold where you can't go back to sleep, and you are just, like, imagining moments where you've been too hot before, and you're like, I would go back to that. Like, I can't believe I was complaining about that. Can I please be in that situation? But it was also really cool because a lot of times if I was staying in a yurt, I was in a more remote area, and the surroundings and the landscape were incredible. So that made up for the moment of discomfort.
And the beds tended to be pretty comfortable.
Yeah. So I was so impressed with sort of how homey they all felt. And a lot of people would say to me, oh, but our ancestors have had like thousands of years to perfect the design of the yurt. And it was like, yeah, okay, they did a great job. So there were these blankets that everyone kept in these decorative chests. So during the day, it was sort of like pushed off to the side of the yurt. And then at night, they'd pull out the chest. And then they would make these piles of blankets that were so comfortable to sleep on. I mean, probably better than some beds that I stayed on throughout the course of my trip.
My guest is writer and stand-up comedian Audrey Murray. Her new memoir is called Open Mic Night in Moscow and Other Stories from My Search for Black Markets, Soviet Architecture, and Emotionally Unavailable Russian Men. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter @KERAThink. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, and my guest this hour is stand-up comedian and writer Audrey Murray. She spent almost a year traveling around the countries of the former Soviet Union and wrote a memoir about it called Open Mic Night in Moscow and Other Stories from My Search for Black Markets, Soviet Architecture, and Emotionally Unavailable Russian Men. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Audrey, how well did you speak Russian when you started your trip?
Not well at all. I wrote about in the book, there was this moment I was flying to Kazakhstan, and for the month before the trip, I had spent about an hour a day studying Russian, and I was feeling pretty good about where I was at. And then on the plane, the flight attendant just asked what I wanted to drink, and I realized I didn't know how to say water, and I didn't know how to say I don't speak Russian, and I was like, oh my God, what have I gotten myself into? But as the trip went on, I had to learn like survival things pretty quickly, and as the trip went on, I got more and more comfortable with the language. I definitely still make a lot of mistakes when I speak, but I feel like I can now like get a SIM card when I land in a Russian-speaking country, which is – that always feels like a good benchmark.
You note, by the way, that Kazakhstan has been luckier than some other former Soviet states because it's got natural resources. But money can't buy democracy. It can't buy freedom of speech. There are people in all of these countries, or many of them, that kind of pine for the old Soviet days.
Yeah, and that really surprised me. I had no idea about that. But there's a lot of Soviet nostalgia. I think less from a freedom and human rights perspective, and more just because in some places, especially in Central Asia, the standard of living has really gone down since the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was definitely a very repressive regime, and it did not necessarily treat minority groups well. But they did bring infrastructure to a lot of areas that hadn't previously had, regular electricity or good roads and things like that. And so especially in Central Asia, yeah, you would meet a lot of people who would speak very positively about Soviet days, because that meant those were days when they had regular electricity, when they had, highways that were not completely cracked. And when I was there, a lot of times you actually did not drive on the highway. You drive sort of on the road beside the highway, like on a dirt path that's been cut out on tire tracks, because that's a smoother ride. So it was understandable, but really surprising when I first encountered it.
Was it, again, your former boyfriend, Anton, who said, like, there's also a self-esteem thing. One night you go to bed and you're part of the Soviet Union, which Soviets saw as the most powerful country on earth. The next morning you wake up and you're in Belarus.
Yeah, and I just think that is such a perfect way to describe it. For me, anyway, I really kept that in the back of my mind because, yeah, for a lot of countries, I mean, everyone knew what the Soviet Union was. As Anton lamented often, not everyone, like everyone has kind of heard of Belarus, but most people don't know a lot about it. It's interesting to think of it from that perspective, because I think especially in the U.S., we're often taught to see the collapse of the Soviet Union as sort of a moment to celebrate, a moment where that brought freedom to a huge population, and they don't always see it that way.
Yeah, and there's nothing like travel or like talking to people with different experiences to kind of upend what you didn't even realize was a single kind of limited perspective on things.
Yeah, totally. And that there were just so many moments of that in my book. A lot of it was related to, I think, the Soviet Union. But even sometimes like things that I had assumed about being a woman traveling alone, I think I had assumed that that would be a lot more dangerous than I really felt that it ended up being while I was there. I was really struck by the fact that if you're a woman traveling alone, people looking at you are not necessarily going to realize or assume that. You know, if you're just walking down the street by yourself, no one is going to look at you and say, oh, this person is probably like here alone and also on this long extended trip alone. And so you're a lot less of a target than I think I thought I would be.
You did get kidnapped in Turkmenistan.
Right. That is, yeah, that is probably
sorry to
the best,
like
counter argument. No, but what's so interesting about that, though, is that is really the only, and yeah, it's a big, scary moment, I know. But what surprised me so much was how much of the trip was not like that, mm-hmm. and how many times I felt very safe. But yes, if I could do it all over again, I would not have gone to Turkmenistan alone.
And it was like you got into what you thought was a cab driven by a bad guy, but your sort of spidey sense kicked in enough for you to realize you were in trouble and do something about it.
Yeah, so I was, I write about this in the book. I was in a taxi where we were supposed to be going to a hotel. They drove past the hotel, and then they kept driving really in the complete opposite direction of the hotel. And as I started to get more and more nervous and I started reacting and started yelling, they remained so calm, which was so unnerving at the time. It felt like when I realized something was definitely wrong, because there was definitely like a 10 to 15 minute period where I was like, well, am I overreacting? Is this really happening? And when I realized that it was, I feel like it wasn't even me that took over at that point. We were on a highway driving directly out into the desert, and there was one final on-ramp onto the highway from the airport. And as we were approaching it, I saw that there was a pretty steady stream of traffic coming from the airport, and so I opened the door, the rear door, and that created enough of a diversion that they pulled over and I ran. But thinking back on it now, I'm like almost so impressed that I was able to do that, because it didn't feel like me. It almost felt like it was like adrenaline, or I don't know, like a biological instinct or to survive or something like that.
And then you called the U.S. consulate. What did you do after that?
Yeah, so the first thing I did was I called the U.S. Embassy in Ashgabat, and I was kind of like, hey, so I think I just got kidnapped, and I'm ready for the Navy SEALs to come and rescue me. And they were like, oh, yeah, no, we don't do that. And what really blew my mind was they told me that I should the only thing I could do was to hitchhike back into the city, which seemed so dangerous. And I really did not want to do that. But they were just not. I mean, I guess in Turkmenistan, they do not provide services to Americans in distress. So please know that when you are considering going to Turkmenistan and also maybe filing your taxes. I felt like, what have I been paying for all these years?
All right, let's go to the phones. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Belina is on the line in San Antonio. Hi, Belina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just wanted to share a little bit, and in regards to the comment of the author about the outside world not knowing about Belarus. So I'm myself from Tony Clayton and have been living in the States for 3 years. And I found it really amazing that actually not the outside world, but Americans don't really know about Europe, especially Eastern Europe or Central Asia. And it really amazes me how when I met my husband and he said, I'm from Vermont. And I said, oh, yeah, Vermont, next to Canada. He found that to be amazing, how I, from Ukraine, have never been to the States before, would know where Vermont is. So I just want to find what is the reason behind it? Is it the geographical seclusion or maybe the educational system? And so just wanted to talk a little bit about that. It can be any comment from the author. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I think that's something that I honestly don't really understand either. I don't know if it's the same for you, Chris, but yeah, I definitely don't feel like I learned about Eastern Europe at all in school. I took one course on Western European history. And I think it's also that when these places come up in the news, I think Americans kind of tend to tune out because they're not places that they regularly encounter or travel to. I mean, you know, a lot of people traveling abroad would probably, especially if you don't travel a lot, would probably feel a little bit more comfortable going to like an English-speaking country or Western Europe or something like that. So I think, I also think that once you've been to a place, you're sort of going to be naturally more curious about it for the rest of your life.
If you get far enough off the beaten path, Audrey, do you find that there are people who don't know very much about the United States? Or is like our cultural hegemony such that people have sort of heard of the basic things that Americans would know about?
Yeah, no, I think that's totally, I think a lot of non-Americans do know a lot about the United States, and that's what makes me feel even worse every time I am not very informed about a part of the world. And I think especially in the former Soviet Union, I mean, depending on where I went, but I think you can go a lot of places and find people who consume like American media, whether it's like, you know, sort of like movies or TV shows or music. And I think that provides like more of a natural inroad into just being a little bit generally more aware.
You made this really interesting.
And informed.
Yeah. You made this really interesting observation that, so you traveled, you know, really far afield of where most American tourists would ever go. The one time you felt isolated was when you didn't get Wi-Fi access because you couldn't get a SIM card, and on and on. And then you really felt like you were cut off.
Yeah, because especially sometimes I'd be traveling in places where I would go days without having a conversation in English, and that can be really isolating. Probably not isolating if you are fluent in the language that you're using on a daily basis. But yeah, so it was so important for me to be able to even just like text my family, my sister, or read emails from friends. I felt like that made it feel like if anything ever really went wrong, you know, I was only a plane ride away from everyone that I knew and loved. And yeah, it was so weird how much I did not like not being able to get online. And I think I wish that I had not had that reaction, but it was a little isolating.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and stand-up comedian Audrey Murray. We're talking about her book, Open Mic Night in Moscow, and other stories from my search for black markets, Soviet architecture, and emotionally unavailable Russian men. Let's go back to the phones now. Caroline, or maybe it's Carolyn, is calling from Dallas. Hi.
Hi, it's Caroline. I actually don't have a question for you at all. I just was very inspired at listening to you. I kind of jumped in halfway through and wanted to say that it's very refreshing to hear of a woman that's not scared to go travel way outside of her country. And ultimately, as you said originally, that you didn't have any interest in getting married or having kids at first, I think, and that you weren't necessarily interested in having the perfect job. And I would like to say I'm not either, and it really is just a good thing to hear another woman say that we don't just aspire to marriage. And I've always just kind of winged everything in my life, and it just worked out perfectly. And you kind of made me want to go on a trip Russia myself. So thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. You should go. Yeah, I think I was really surprised by that too. Or I was surprised by how long it took me to sort of accept what I wanted. Especially, I thought of myself as really like a feminist, and still do. And I was really surprised by how much I'd bought into, or not bought into so much as felt pressure that other people were putting on me that I didn't necessarily want for myself.
So to be clear, you were a full-on adult. You were 28 years old when you started this trip. But I wonder if you still felt the need to sort of explain to like your parents, members of your family, like why you wanted to do this. Were they supportive? Did they worry about you?
Oh, yeah. I felt the need to explain it because everyone was really worried about it, especially my parents. You know, they had gotten used to, I had been in China at that point. I'd lived in China for a few years. And so they had gotten used to the idea of me being in a foreign country, but I think they were very nervous about me traveling through this part of the world alone specifically. And yeah, you're right. You know, when you said you were an adult, that was sort of a moment where I was like, oh, yeah, I was. I don't know why I felt like I had to get permission from my family and friends. But I did feel that way a little bit.
I think sometimes when someone else is really worried for you, that allows you to not do any worrying. You almost respond by pushing back against that.
Right, because you want to say, oh, no, I can handle this. I can. Yeah, definitely. I've always been the type of person who thrives on other people telling me I can't do something or I shouldn't do something. And not always. Actually, often it's been a good thing. That was originally what brought me to China as well.
All right. Let's speak now on the phone with Jesse in Dallas. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. So I was listening to the story about your kidnapping, which was very fascinating to hear, and it got me wondering, when you went on this trip or before you went on this trip, did you have any peace of mind knowing, like, you know, like here in America, you can call 911 if you're ever in an emergency? Did you have any plans in place for safety in case something like that were to happen?
No, so a lot of times I would only think I should really know what the version of 911 in this country is when it was already too late to look that up. I think I felt safe because I knew that I was going to have my cell phone with me the entire time. And I knew that I had set something up so that if I didn't get a local SIM card, I could at least, like, if I had to make calls and get on the internet and things like that. So I think that was kind of what gave me the biggest sense of security, was knowing that I would always have a way to contact someone that could help me. But yeah, there were a lot of that situation in the cab, especially. I was sitting there thinking, like, what would I guess the number for 911 is here?
My guest is writer and stand-up comedian Audrey Murray. Her memoir is called Open Mic Night in Moscow and Other Stories from My Search for Black Markets, Soviet Architecture, and Emotionally Unavailable Russian Men. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. To think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Audrey Murray about her trip through 11 of the 15 former Soviet countries. Her new memoir is called Open Mic Night in Moscow and Other Stories from My Search for Black Markets, Soviet Architecture, and Emotionally Unavailable Russian Men. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. At one point, you were in Tajikistan and you stepped over the border into Afghanistan to take a selfie. Will you talk about what that felt like?
It was so crazy because if you had told me before I did that it would feel like anything to be so close to the border with Afghanistan and to just put boots on the ground, I would have said, oh, no, yeah, it wouldn't be a big deal. But actually, I ended up feeling, I don't know, very like momentous, because I had spent 5 days on a road trip along the border with Afghanistan, and we were so close. I mean, we were driving right next to a river, and across the river, it was Afghanistan, and we could see people, you know, walking down the road and things like that. And I was traveling with a French man that I met through the tour guide, and we were both really struck by how crazy it was, how close we were, the fact that we could see it. And I think for both of us, when we just sort of like slipped across the border, yeah, stood in Afghanistan for 2 seconds and then ran back in, we both really felt like, wow, this is a place that we have heard so much about and has sort of, for my lifetime anyway, always been in the news as a place that the U.S. was at war with or that the Soviet Union was at war with. And so I think to do that felt really powerful in a way I wasn't expecting.
It's always interesting to consider how arbitrary borders are. I mean, even when there's a river between two countries, I mean, that's the situation along the Rio Grande between the U.S. and Mexico. It's just people who decided that one country ends here and the next begins there.
Right, yeah. And I think it's, you notice it even more when you cross a lot of land borders, which is what I was doing in Central Asia. You're kind of driving between the countries. And what's so crazy is that when you cross a border on foot, there's a, you know, there's clearly a line somewhere that separates the two countries. But the way that you cross it is you exit the first country at one guardhouse, and then you drive for like 10 or 15 minutes before you hit the guardhouse that takes you into the next country. And you realize, like, all that land in between is sort of like a no man's land type strip. And the fact that at one point it ticks over to the other country, it almost doesn't feel like it's actually a line. It feels like more of an expanse that the two countries have decided is safe enough to sort of face each other at.
What was it like to visit Chernobyl?
It was very different than what I was expecting. I thought that Chernobyl was going to be a deserted, sort of like post-apocalyptic wasteland. And I wasn't planning to go at all, actually. I was at a hostel in Kiev, and a bunch of us went out for the night to this strangely insane asylum-themed bar nearby. And everyone started talking about Chernobyl and how it was so easy to go. There were these companies that would take you on a day trip. And I was sort of like, okay, I guess. You know, I was like, is it dangerous? And they were like, no, it's not dangerous. They showed me all these websites where they explain that they travel with this device that shows you exactly how much radiation is being emitted wherever you are. And I got there, and what I was so struck by was the degree to which actually it was not abandoned. We actually went to the power plant where the Chernobyl accident happened, and the power plant was still operating at the time. People were still working there in the other three reactors, and that was just so crazy. I mean, there are areas that have been pretty thoroughly abandoned, and that's where they take tourists, and you get these like crazy photos of like an abandoned amusement park. But the real story that I found was that amusement park had never opened, actually. It was scheduled to be open the week after the accident. And so it's definitely something that looks one way in pictures, and when you're there, it feels very different.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. Norma is on the line in Dallas. Hi, Norma. Norma,
hello. Hi. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I'm fascinated by this trip and all the adventures you have. I have a two-part question. The first is, before you went, I know that there used to be state information from the U.S. about different areas and different countries, and should you travel there, shouldn't you travel there, what are the risks? Is that something that you kind of went over, kind of considered? And secondly, now that you've been in these places, would you approach your decision to go to different areas differently
Thanks
than
for
you
your
did
call.
Before this trip?
Yeah, so I'm familiar with the State Department website that tells you what to do for each country. And I've actually been on, I signed up for some sort of notification while I was living in China. So when there's like a dangerous situation, I get an alert for that. But on the whole, I don't think I really paid too much attention to that. I think I went more by what I found in information and also travel forums where people who had spent a lot of time in these places share their expertise. And I don't think I would have gone to a place that the State Department says we don't recommend Americans go to, like North Korea. But I was familiar with them, and I definitely got like emails whenever there was some sort of emergency, but I didn't really check those pages while I was traveling. I think the second part of the question, would I approach it differently? I don't know. I mean, what happened in Turkmenistan is definitely the one thing I walked away from the trip thinking, how could I have avoided that? Or what would I do differently? And that's one thing where I've really said, I wish I had gone on an organized tour with other people to Turkmenistan. But otherwise, I don't know. I've always been kind of a person who lives, flies by the seat of my pants. So I'm not sure that I would do it that much differently were I to attempt something like this again.
All right, talk about Soviet architecture. I think a lot of people like the idea of sort of classical Russian architecture. You know, everybody pictures St. Basil's Cathedral. What did you find interesting about Soviet-era architecture?
Oh, my God. First of all, it's just huge. You sort of get the sense that, like, some of the factories and streets and just government buildings that were built during that the Soviet period, especially sort of post-World War II, I was sometimes like, did the architect accidentally triple the proportions? I mean, they were just so big. There was one I remember. It was, I think, the National Museum of Kazakhstan in Almaty. And I think I write in the book that when you walk through it, you almost feel like the building was designed so that the entire population of Kazakhstan could fit inside it if they all decided to visit the museum on the same day. But there were still, like, I think there was still some beauty to that as well. I mean, obviously some of the more later era kind of concrete prefabricated apartment blocks that we think of. Actually, to be honest, even those I found sort of like charming in their own way. There was always an attention to detail. So even those like concrete buildings would sometimes have this like lattice work on the exterior or be painted a really bright color. Yeah. And the most striking thing when you're in this part of the world are the bus stops that the Soviet Union built, because I think I read a rumor somewhere that the architects were allowed total freedom with bus stops. And so you'll get these crazy bus stops of, like, you know, sometimes it'll be something like the bus stop is a giant statue of a dove that doesn't even provide protection from the elements for people waiting for the bus. But it's, you know, you're driving down the side of the highway and you're like, what is that? That's a bus stop?
I guess maybe in like a culture that is otherwise repressive, people find ways to be creative.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's what my understanding of where those came from is that it was that. I guess maybe the Soviet government was like, it's just a bus stop. How bad, you know, how much damage could it really do?
All right. Let's go next to Michael in San Antonio. Hi, Michael.
Hey, how's it going? First off, good on you for taking such an awesome trip. When I was younger, I did the same thing throughout Melanesia, Micronesia, just kind of going fly by pants, enjoying what it was. But I come from an interesting family. My father's Mexican-American, and my mother's Russian. Her family came from the Soviet era. And so we kind of grew up, I grew up in the 80s. And at that time, clearly every bad guy in every movie was either, you know, Russian, Soviet, Kazakh, something like that. And so it's something we pervasively grew up with this sense of, as the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, we'd been brought up with a lot of pride at what the Soviet Union had done in math and science and technology, and then it was just kind of gone. So you mentioned that earlier. Is that something that's fairly pervasive throughout all the people you kind of interacted with? I mean, I certainly was raised with this pride, and then around the 90s, we just kind of stopped talking about stuff.
Thanks for your call. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Go ahead, Audrey.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting that he mentioned that, because I know exactly what he's talking about in terms of even my current boyfriend is from Ukraine, and his family, I think, still has a lot of pride for certain things that the Soviet Union did that were really impressive. I mean, the biggest thing is always the Soviet Union pretty much took a fairly illiterate population, and there was almost universal literacy rates, I think 20 years in. So, yeah, I think it's a more complicated, I think, relationship. One thing I notice, people will often talk about Soviet culture as something that they see as different from Russian culture or whatever country they happen to be in now. And I think when they say Soviet culture, they are sort of referring to, I guess, maybe a rosier picture of it, the more positive elements. But I always find that interesting because, of course, the Soviet Union really didn't allow a lot of cultural works to be made, especially in terms of art and things like that. So it's always weird for me to know whether to call something Russian culture or Soviet culture, or I don't know. Maybe we need, like, in Russian they have the word Ruski kind of refers to all of that in a way that's not tied to a country. And yeah, I think I definitely, I heard people using that term to sort of separate the two, or to sort of like refer to the good elements of the Soviet Union.
Is your Ukrainian boyfriend more emotionally available than his predecessor?
He is. Yes, he is so wonderful and so emotionally available. What? It's a real change of pace for me.
Do you feel like that was something cultural with the others, or did you just happen to, I mean, lots of people might date two or three people in a row who aren't quite a good fit emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I don't really think it had anything to do with the culture at all. I think it was very circumstantial. Yeah, I think I was just, I think the more interesting thing for me was that I kept being drawn to Russians specifically for no good reason that I could seem to point to.
Do you think that intrepid travelers are just built of different stuff than tourist travelers? Or do you believe that everybody could find a capacity for this kind of travel, presuming that they are, you know, healthy enough to make a trip?
Yeah, I definitely think that anyone could do this, because I think the thing that also surprised me was that before you do something like this, you can find a million different things to worry about. But when you're actually in that situation, when you're on the ground in Uzbekistan, things that would have seemed really overwhelming, like, for example, in Uzbekistan, I write about the fact that I had to buy all of my currency on the black market.
Right.
When you're there, it just kind of becomes more of like an errand that you're doing. And, you know, you're being able to eat dinner that night depends on it. And so I think it's somehow like you become less dramatic about it. You're like, OK, I got to find a way to make this work. And often you do. And so I don't think that's anything special about me. I think anyone could do that. I think the big difference is just buying the ticket. I think that's really the hurdle for a lot of people, because you can worry through every worst case scenario before you go.
We just have a few seconds left. Did you hear a joke in Russian that still sticks with you that translates to English?
Yes. Can I tell it in English only, though? Because I'm not sure.
Yes.
I remember how
Real quick.
It goes.
Absolutely.
In Russian. Okay. So it was this woman, and she was saying, you know, when you're younger, you want a partner who's like perfect. But now that I'm in my 30s, I just want a man who can read and eat dinner with a fork. And I forget the third one, but I loved it so much because you could hear that joke literally anywhere in America, in China. It was so universal.
Audrey Murray's new memoir is called Open Mic Night in Moscow and Other Stories from My Search for Black Markets, Soviet Architecture, and Emotionally Unavailable Russian Men. Audrey, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for making time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Alan Roberts ran the board for us today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Twitter at KERAThink. You can subscribe to the podcast at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.